Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, August 6th, 2023. My name is Bill McCann. We'll start with the talk section, interviews by David Marchese. Robert Downey Jr.'s post-Marvel balancing act. This summer, Robert Downey Jr. says, is the battle for the soul of cinema. Like a lot of other things said by the actor who co-stars in the thriller Oppenheimer, directed by Christopher Nolan and opening in theaters on July 21st, that statement was delivered with a soupçon of knowing sarcasm. But there's truth to it. In a cinematic season dominated by series, superheroes, and pre-existing IP, all aimed at the widest possible market, whether there is still a theater-going audience sizable enough to sustain the work of a highly individualistic, highly ambitious director like Nolan, whose latest is a three-hour epic focusing on, among other weighty themes, the moral dilemmas faced by the title character, called the father of the atomic bomb, remains an open question. In the film, Downey plays Louis Strauss, the former chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission and the chief antagonist of J. Robert Oppenheimer, played by Cillian Murphy. As if that weren't enough, the film also represents a career reset, famously not the first for Downey, who in June premiered Downey's Dream Cars, a docuseries in which some of his classic cars were refitted to be more eco-friendly. It's been an awfully long time since the 58-year-old has shown up in a big movie playing a major part that wasn't Tony Stark, also known as Iron Man, or other would-be franchise material. You start to wonder, says Downey, a rollicking and digressive talker, if a muscle you have hasn't atrophied. And David asks, even though Christopher Nolan is a marquee name, a movie like Oppenheimer isn't exactly a guaranteed box office slam dunk. Then consider that in the light of a show like Perry Mason, which your company co-produced and which everyone seemed to like, but that wasn't enough to keep it from being canceled. So from where you're sitting, do you feel as if you're able to make sense of the business right now? Since my ship came in 2008 when Iron Man had that big weekend, I've been a self-described expert on the ways of the world of creativity and commerce. It's not that the playing field changes, it's that it morphs into something that you can't even really call a playing field anymore. It's a kind of mosaic of what it was moments before. If I'm running a major streamer, which sounds like a big number one, how serious is it if the mind immediately goes to pee-pee? Anyway, you look at the budget, you look at the numbers, and it comes down to a spreadsheet. But how does knowing that affect your choices about what to make? You just go on. Welcome to Thunderdome. I think it has been great in that we can all say that not one of us can entirely hit our ass with both hands right now. So let's just keep doing what we believe in the best course of action. Have you talked with Tom Cruise about this competition between Mission Impossible and Oppenheimer to be on more IMAX screens? Nah. I said, it's Thunderdome out there. Everybody's trying to do what they can. There's a scramble going on, and what a glory to behold. David, if there is, as you said, a battle going on for the soul of cinema, do you feel any ambivalence about having been such a key part of the Marvel movies, which pretty much ate Hollywood movie making? If you're talking about adjusted for inflation, the biggest movies of all time, Gone with the Wind and the Ten Commandments are there. I'm sure that in the years those movies came out, there were probably films that you and I would agree were a better representation of what cinema can be. I didn't have the luxury of wondering what the longer-term repercussions of coming in as a second-tier superhero for something that was going to build out into a cinematic universe would be. And it didn't matter because I had a Super Bowl ring on each finger while this debate was being contested with much heat. The other side of it is that I was raised in a family that rebelled against the idea of a summer blockbuster having any merit and thought that the films that were preferred viewing that year weren't any good either. So coming from that other place, entering the box office weekend dominating place, then going into this spot now where I'm happy that I'm in this quality product, I'm happy that I regained my connection with a more purist approach to making movies. Is it right that you're remaking Vertigo? We're certainly looking into it. You know why? No, but that seems crazy. Exactly. Not even risky. Advisably ridiculous to even consider. Great, let's look into it. First of all, who would our partners be in it? Love them, respect them. Second of all, let me reread the original synopsis. I think we can do better, he laughs. God bless, David says. And then Robert, I'll tell you why. I've been rock climbing before and gotten stuck in that panic freeze. And if not for the sheer embarrassment, I would have asked to have been hoisted off that rock. I lost my confidence in my positioning. The drop was too far. My body reacted. It wasn't fight or flight. It was freeze and about to faint. I'll never forget it. It made me think there are cinematic devices that have yet to be fully utilized that I think would provide an experience in trying to say, what does it feel like to be psychologically silly with fear over something that should be manageable? That might be entertaining. David, but you're obviously in a phase of your career, post-Marvel, in which I assume you only have to work when you want to. You've also got plenty going on outside acting, so how do you decide what movies to do? At this point, you're not doing it for the money. Were you ever doing it for the money once your baseline needs were met? Probably not. Did you think it was about money and prestige? Probably from the time I was a teenager, until that illusion dissolved in front of me, leaving me in a depressive state. But then there's the why. I don't know why I can relate to Louis Strauss so much, but I felt like I was meant to play this role, and I knew I'd be in capable hands. Oppenheimer has been a bit of a demarcation line for me. Why? I finished the Marvel contract and then hastily went into what had all the promise of being another big, fun, well-executed potential franchise in Doolittle. I had some reservations. Me and my team seemed a little too excited about the deal and not quite excited enough about the merits of the execution. But at that point, I was bulletproof. I was the guru of all genre movies. Honestly, the two most important films I've done in the past 25 years are The Shaggy Dog, because that was the film that got Disney saying they would insure me. Then the second most important film was Doolittle, because Doolittle was a 2.5-year wound of squandered opportunity. The stress it put on my missus as she rolled her sleeves up to her armpits to make it even serviceable enough to bring to market was shocking. After that point, what's that phrase? Never let a good crisis go to waste. We had this reset of priorities and made some changes in who our closest business advisors were. And that whole time, my dad was passing away. And as an avoidance mechanism, I decided to send Cruz over and get his thoughts on his winter years. And that turned into senior. Probably the most important thing I'll ever do, which was being able to become part object and subject within a piece of content, which is what it was. But to me, it was meaningful. Then old Chris Nolan calls, and getting to see the Spartan, almost monastic way he approaches this art form, it was like going to the other side of the moon. So I guess my answer to your question is, I'm a dedicated martial arts student, and it's great to spar with someone who is more dangerous than you. Do you remember when the money prestige illusion dissolved for you? About 2 weeks after me and John and Kevin, that's John Favreau, director of Iron Man, and Kevin Feige, the president of Marvel Studios, were pumping fists at Giorgio Baldi in the private room, and the numbers kept getting bigger for the first weekend of the first Iron Man. It was gung-ho, masters of the universe, until I went to bed on night 13. I must have processed out all of the projection that had been on those external markers of what I should feel great about. I went into a K-hole. How come? That drive that had been built up by being the kid on the other side of the fence, there was no longer a purpose for that. The water broke on what had seemingly been this unrequited thing. But what was requited? You realize you still have grief about A, B, or C, or a not particularly irrational fear that D, E, or F could happen. These external goals, there's only so much space on the hard drive to function, and it was all geared toward getting this thing. And then when you meet it, it just goes, okay, big shot. Can we get back to the process of unpacking a lifetime of experiences, fears, hopes, and desires? David says, in that decade plus when you were mostly doing Marvel movies, did you have any concerns about what effect that might have on your acting? I say that as someone who thought you did amazing work with Tony Stark, but you did play the same role for a long time. Yes, 100%. I knew there was a point where Chris Nolan was endorsing, let's work those other muscles, but let's do it while rendering you devoid of your usual go-to things. What are your go-to things? It's the fast-talking, charming, unpredictable, blah, 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 or as my very close friend Josh Richman, a character actor, used to say, I made my bones playing Milo, the offbeat buddy. And Milo, the offbeat buddy, better be offbeat. Just to connect this back to Oppenheimer, in doing a bunch of research on Strauss, I connected it to my own grandfather, who would have been a contemporary of his. Robert Elias, whom I never met, was in the U.S. Army, self-made guy. There's a cool simile between something he was involved in and how Strauss probably felt about Oppenheimer. This grandfather helped do the glass for the Chrysler building, and the Chrysler and the Empire State were vying to be the biggest. So I was thinking, how can I make Strauss's competitiveness with Oppenheimer personal? And it was. Look at that building over there. That's no better than mine getting all that the shine. I don't think there's another human being alive that can't admit to having fallen into the vagaries of comparison. I also relate to, for reasons in a part of my life that I don't discuss with press, the recovery stuff, the amount of service that was involved in Strauss's life and the dedication to an ideal. There's always going to be variances in opinion, but I had an easy time making a case for why this individual was right. I respect that there are things you don't talk about in interviews, but can you make the connection for me between Strauss's sense of service and your own? I'm not following. I'm saying that doing the right thing for the right reasons gives you an advantage in spirit. For instance, my son is in Little League. He also thinks I am his personal PT masseuse. I'm like, dude, I love you, but do I really have to give you another foot rub? Once I get past that and realize, yes, I've had a long day, but he's probably had a longer day. There's this sacred moment when he's already fallen asleep and I'm still doing my shiatsu moves on him, and you just feel right size. You're getting so much gratification from this process of putting yourself in this position of service, and no one's keeping score. That's something that I learned as I was tunneling my way back to being a functioning member of society, one teaspoon of dirt at a time. And looking at Strauss, I saw that he was a guy who had his nose to the grindstone and was a civil servant for decades. I have something I can relate to. David, that tunneling your way back line is reminding me of something I wanted to ask about. I watched this 2004 clip of you on Oprah about a year after you got clean, and the subtext of the interview is that you were bad, and now you have to convince everyone that you're good, which is a dynamic that shows up in so many old TV appearances and magazine articles about you. I'm curious to know how you understood the public's expectation for how a celebrity is supposed to behave in order to earn redemption. I remember with great pride that I was able to even address something like that in a public forum. Yet it would irk me deeply. felt strangely punitive and unnecessarily humiliating. The challenge, though, is, yeah, so what? Expletive, what you're going through. Can you show up for this? There's a great story about this guy. This would never play nowadays. He was in one of his last Zen trainings, and he was told to go to the lingerie section at Lord & Taylor and just stand there until women felt uncomfortable. It's this idea of purposefully putting yourself in a situation where you'll feel judged. The only difference between that misguided, aspiring Zen master and me is I didn't sign up to have that kind of experience. But once you're there, you got to roll with the punches. I'm close with people right now who have gotten caught up in this iteration of the pendulum, like nature of culture deciding who is and isn't okay. It's baffling. But yeah, shock, self-damnation, feeling exposed, feeling disabused of any progress you might have made. We're also talking about me in my 40s and 30s, and there's something great about pushing 60, which is I still have many of the old defects. I just know them so well. They're like telemarketers. It's like, come on, guys. What advice are you giving to people you're close with who the culture has decided are not okay? I feel a bit fugazi when I'm trying to apply the metrics of the 80s, 90s, and the early aughts to what's occurred in the last 5 or 7 years. But I think there's usually a 2-year turnaround on sinking to the depths of the Mariana Trench until you get back up to the surface. You come up too quick, we know what happens. There are many points in a comeback or being seen in a favorable light by your peers that, I'll speak for myself, I wanted to happen sooner than it did, and I felt victimized by the timeline. But mankind's greatest challenge is to be still, stay on the bus. The scenery's changing. You don't get to decide where you get off the bus. The driver will let you know when you've arrived at your stop. But that's the intolerable thing of how will I know when this nightmare is over? How do you know? Because you wake up. David says, during that period when your off-screen life was so chaotic, you took a bunch of roles that had an element of daring to them, whether it was chaplain or hearts and souls or natural-born killers or black and white. Maybe the sympathizer is a return to that. Maybe in a way, Oppenheimer is too. But post-comeback, you seem to step away from those riskier parts. Was there a connection between living a wilder life and pursuing riskier parts? Or maybe it's having a more stable life and wanting more stable parts. That element of risk, is this something that is relatively low or mid degree of difficulty? Or is this something that to fail at is to be walking between two large buildings? What was that guy's name? Philippe Petit? Thank you. Or is a sweet petit moment? I never intentionally started saying, let me do something that feels like a little more low-hanging fruit. I would just be in varying stages of self-deception where I could say, oh, I can make this huge stretch. But really, it's more of the same. It's not a rude awakening with Chris Nolan, because all those memory banks of I should probably be off book for these 80 pages of dialogue. What? We don't need to do that anymore. Shut up. You can do this. What if your brain has gone jelly numb from all your conspicuous consumption? As it turns out, it all has gone nowhere. It was confirmation that very little atrophies when you get shaken out of whatever version of complacency you might have been in. How much does it matter for you to be able to personally relate to a character in the way that you related to Louis Strauss? Actually, let me ask this question using examples from your career. In Two Girls and a Guy, there's a scene where your character is looking in the mirror, excoriating himself. And it's easy to watch that and assume that the self-loathing on display was being drawn from your own life. But then there's something like Home for the Holidays, where you give this totally relaxed, charming performance. In both cases, your life at the time was a mess. But did one or the other performance feel truer to you? Hold on. Let's get this straight. Home for the Holidays, for me, is the most relaxed performance in the history of cinema, brought to you courtesy of Black Tar Heroin. Two girls and a guy. Those were Toback's loose words put together in his assessment of this character's self-damnation. That was an end of the day. We've got a mag of film left. Here's a dumb idea. And yet I learned as much from that as anything I've ever done up to that, with the exception of Chaplin. It's that Spencer Tracy approach. Stand there, be honest, with a little undercutting at the end. It was a gauche way of trying to express that, but I was relatively young. I guess what I'm trying to get at is how much your performances tend to be rooted in your personal experience. Because unlike with a lot of other actors, I have no idea how important being able to personally identify with a character is or isn't for your approach to acting. I'll say this. I don't know. I did less than zero with a director, Marek Kazveska, who understood that what I didn't, which is we're doing something incredibly artistic. This guy is a mess, probably going to get worse, but he's not as bad as the character he's playing. Can he have an experience whereby it may spare him years of untold agony? The answer was no, but it was a question worth asking. Then I had other characters and other things where I put on a mask, and in putting on the mask, I'm free to subject the screen to my unconscious dialogue, which I find hilarious, engaging, and wrought with bad clown energy. Then there's things that feel kind of in the sweet spot. I had an experience in Pasadena on Oppenheimer where we were doing a driving shot, and it's me and Nolan and Hoyt, the DP, and this driver. And it's all been set up, and we had to address something on the car. The rig or something wasn't right. At one point, Nolan was like, "I'm going to step out here. Take this." And he put a mag of film in my lap. I was brought back to that first time I was really on set with my dad, the smell of film. And it was almost like in the 5 minutes that I was sitting there, he gave me back my cellular dignity as someone who belongs in the position I found myself. At the beginning of the conversation, you referred to Senior as content. I'm guessing you wouldn't use that word to describe Oppenheimer. So what's content and what's not? Put on the list and I'll tell you yes or no. Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, not content. Avengers, Age of Ultron, content. U.S. Marshals, debatable. Back to School, not content. Do you have a Rodney Dangerfield story? Oh yeah, the first time I went to meet him, he opened the door of his apartment wearing a terry cloth robe. The belt for the robe undid itself as he was opening the door. So the first part of Rodney Dangerfield I ever experienced were his kiwis. It was unadulterated joy from that moment. "Come on in. You mind if I smoke some expletive?" "Nope, that's not going to be a problem, Rodney." Another time we were shooting a scene and he said, "Watch this." "Oh, my ankle. Ah, expletive." That was on a Thursday, 3-day weekend. Honestly, let me tell you why I use the word content. Yeah, Senior is so personal, but to everyone else it was a piece of content that they could have chosen to click on and watch or not. How's that different from anything else you do? Whether it's a movie or Downey's dream cars or your business ventures, you put things out there and people engage with it or not, right? Because it's a way for me to let myself know that just because this may be the most important thing that I ever commit to a data card on a camera doesn't mean it isn't expletive content to everyone else. You know, there's a part of me that thinks I should be a writer or an entrepreneur or I could blah, blah, blah. But then I think about it and go, I've made my peace with what I am at my core. There's really only one thing I've ever been any goddamn good at. So to keep imagining I'm going to suddenly transform into this formidable multi-hyphenate, I'm just starting to not buy my own hype. It's about, can I feel good about what I'm doing? Okay, yes. Then I'll feel good about it. Now I'll read a letter of recommendation. I've listened to this breakup song a million times. Why does it feel so good to cry this hard? It's an article by Brontez Purnell. I'm mobbing through Bushwick, Brooklyn, in the back of a cab, listening to Lady Ray's Piece of Me for the 12th time in a row. And I'm crying very, very hard. And no, it's not ugly crying. In fact, I'm pretty sure I look beautiful right now. There is no greater balm in the universe than a black woman singing. I said what I said. I remember being a young gay boy in San Francisco hanging out at the Eagle Bar in Soma when an older white guy explained to me that he only talks to black women therapists. He went on, I like my health care like I like my house music. I want a beautiful black woman telling me that everything is going to be okay. I was 23 and literally balked at the nerve of this man. I hate to admit it, but now that I'm 41 and I finally maybe understand what things like heartbreak are about, I completely agree with him. There has to be a reason it's called soul music, right? Perhaps because that's where it grips you the most. In my short lifetime, I feel like I've seen every nationality, age group, and social class of singer do their jarring impersonations of a black woman singing soul. But cultural erasure be damned. It's like Tammy and Marvin sang, ain't nothing like the real thing, God damn it. Why this song? I wasn't even breaking up with anybody the first time I heard it in an Oakland bar, and the opening lines cut like a knife. You've been the best at times. You walk me through my darkest days. Why must it turn around? A few months later, I was in New York on what I thought would be my final rock and roll tour. I'd been playing music since I was 12 and had achieved two goals I'd had since I was a kid, signing to the legendary indie label Sub Pop and opening for Bikini Kill. My lifelong obsession with music had seemed to reach its logical conclusion. I decided it was time to get a new hobby, like baking or veganism. I was saying goodbye to a part of my life, and I felt an internal shift. What next? Eventually, I ended up in the back of a cab in Bushwick, listening to the song on repeat. I had been listening to Nicole Ray before the Lady Days, a California-born soul singer with that kind of irresistible, honey-dipped voice one can only be born with, no doubt, since the 90s when Missy Elliott gave her a vote of confidence by rapping on her debut single, Make It Hot. But the thing I think I love most about Piece of Me, and really about every song about heartache, heartbreak, or love lost, is that its conviction is all in the delivery. You've either lived through loss or you haven't. And no amount of frenzied vocal trilling can make it otherwise. You can't fake this. I'll let you take a piece of me. And if that's not enough, I'll let you go peacefully. I tear up as I type it. What Lady Ray did here is both genuine and colossal. Her voice transfixes me because she's got that element of soul, hell, of singing in general, that one cannot reach by just hitting the right notes. That's only a small part. One must also land the character one is invoking. The perfect breakup song must also be a sort of theater where the singer becomes the character fully. The very cadence of the song, her voice, sonically pristine, still spells out a certain longing and despair. Remember the definition of soul? The spiritual part of both human being or animal regarded as simultaneously immaterial and immortal? I'm transformed every time I hear Piece of Me, which by the end of the night will probably be close to 30 times. Piece of Me gives that throwback feel. It's heavy. The digital world exists in a cloud, and the music itself feels ethereal. For all our complaints about AI taking over music, I would like to point out that this was foreshadowed more than a decade ago when auto-tune became omnipresent, condensing all emotion into that tinny computer sound. Piece of Me sits in counterpoise, a song mixed through tape reels and heavy wooden machinery. It feels as if the song were creating its own black hole when it was made. Who can escape the condensed emotional singularity of a breakup song? I grew up in Alabama, and I thought I defected to punk rock as a teenager. I was a child of the blues. My great-grandfather, Hard Rock Charlie, played the Chitlin' circuits from Chattanooga to Chicago in the 1930s. His son, J.J. Malone, who came to California in his youth to play music, much like I did, worked alongside the likes of Big Mama Thornton, John Lee Hooker, and Creedence Clearwater Revival. It's in my blood to understand a very true, very sad, very beautiful song. But who among us has not experienced deep loss, yet still found a way to keep going? Piece of Me taps into that universal fact, reiterating the troubled paradox of both love and life. We are forever heartbroken and forever hopeful. Brontez Purnell is a California-based writer whose books include 100 Boyfriends, which won the 2022 Lambda Literary Award in Gay Fiction. I'm going to read another letter of recommendation. The exercise that changed my body, that changed my relationship with my body. When I was diagnosed with a chronic illness in my early 20s, a local pool helped me find new ways to move. A story by Jen Shapland. In the locker room, women's voices discuss the temperature of the air, too cold. Their gardens, the weeds, their sisters, impossible. I eavesdrop as I put on my one piece and flip-flops, grab my bag of toys. Lightly, I bypass the lap pool. Not once in my adult life have I craved more repetitive activity. Instead, I set up shop on the side of the warm water pool, foam weights, kickboard, noodle, and slipping into the 92-degree water, I sense a holy transition. The others arrive by way of a long ramp, discarding canes or walkers, hoisting themselves from wheelchairs, fingers trailing in deepening water. It's a runway, but no one looks at them. The Santa Fe Community College warm water pool is not a place to be seen. Like many of these women recovering from surgery, injuries, or the vicissitudes of life, I've had to learn a new body. In my early 20s, I was diagnosed with POTS, Postural Orthostatic Tachycardia Syndrome, chronic illness whose symptoms include extreme physical fatigue. I'd always fainted from standing too long for the sixth grade class fish dissection or running a mile in gym class, but now I was fainting while sitting in a chair, woozy every time I stood. The cardiologist offered me salt pills, sent me on my way. POTS was then understudied, like many ailments found chiefly in women. But astronauts had long reported feeling dizzy as they returned from space, and NASA investigated the underlying cause, orthostatic intolerance, or a struggle with standing up, of which POTS is a type. 5 years after my diagnosis, I told a student of a NASA-funded researcher how I was unable to stand for my 8-hour bookstore shift without leaning most of my weight on the counter, how I fell asleep on my lunch breaks. She responded with my personal nightmare, an exercise regimen. At first, I could barely manage 5 minutes or on a rowing machine or a recumbent bike. With POTS, I felt so heavy. Mornings, I'd moan to my partner, "I'm in the well." Unable to lift my own head, I propped myself up on a series of pillows to get out of bed. Pathetically, valiantly, I worked my way up to 15 minutes of recumbent exercise, to 30 minutes, to walking on a treadmill. I read a book the entire time, dense post-structural theory, so excruciatingly bored was I by the foot-smelling university gym. Still, it astonished me I could do any of this with my Grinch heart. I graduated to walks outside in the Texas swelter and swims in the neighborhood pool. Something shifted during those first dips, treading water and dodging toddlers. I wasn't weightless, but gravity had less a hold on me. If I started going to the pool because of POTS, I kept going back to be surrounded blissfully by what the poet Lisa Robertson calls she-dandies, women past their childbearing years who are finally free to be useless to capitalism, to be improductive with their bodies. In Santa Fe, which, if you squint, resembles a lesbian separatist retirement community, most creatures of the pool are postmenopausal women. I'd place the median age at 70. Robertson might be describing one of my pool mates when she writes, "She has entered an undocumented corporality. Excellent. Now the scintillating research can begin." I, too, feel my corporality is undocumented. As a 36-year-old queer woman who isn't having children, I have a deep affinity for the postmenopausal. My body, now that I'm able to use it, is for me to enjoy. I make up the exercises as I go. The sound system blares hits of the 80s, from the resplendent Tina Turner to the abysmal Tom Petty. I test my strength against the water with the foam weights. Astride our noodles, we paddle past one another with a nod, a smile, maritime voyagers held aloft by neon foam and salinity. The women often bounce in small circles together, where they trade recipes or describe birds they've seen. Once, a few months after my mother died suddenly, at age 72, I heard a group of them planning to meet at Starbucks after their swim. I considered following them, showing up to coffee. I'm sure they would have welcomed me. I suspect that the she-dandies are in the pool for the same reason I am. Whatever burdens their bodies have borne over the decades, in the water they find lightness, suspension. None of us are counting laps or reps. We are transported by immersion to a different realm altogether. I watch someone wind her new shoulder in its socket and see the amazement on her face. Who knew I could do this? The ethos of the pool reminds me I am meant to move more slowly in the water and out. My body is temporary. My job is to relish the time I have in it. In the pool, time slows down. On bad days, cardio is a struggle. Bolstered by the water, I can do things impossible on land. Surrounded by other time-worn bodies, I feel sublime. I'm an astronaut, an intergalactic wanderer recently arrived on Earth. I balance on one foot, hold a headstand, flip my tail in a dolphin dive, float on my back, gaze at the rubber ducks glued to the ceiling beams, and kick my way across the pool. The coven and I conduct our research, finding new ways to move. Each of us gently, instinctively, makes room for one another. We imagine, for once, that no one can tell us what to do with our bodies. Jen Shapland, that's J-E-N-N, is the author of my autobiography of Carson McCullers, Tin House Books, 2021. Her essay collection, Thin Skin, Pantheon, 2023, comes out in August. And now I'll share a letter to the ethicist, Kwame Anthony Appiah. My friend is trapped in a nursing home. What can I do? The magazine's ethicist columnist on helping people who are institutionalized against their will. And the letter reads, 5 years ago, I began volunteering as a bill payer for a legally blind 95-year-old woman on public assistance. The job involved handling paperwork that clients could no longer handle themselves, thus helping enable them to remain at home. I came to learn that this woman had no family or friends left, and she came to think of me as her only friend. During my time with her, she was also put under the care of Adult Protective Services, APS, because one of her caregivers was fraudulently using her credit card. Last August, she fell out of bed in the middle of the night. A caregiver found her the next morning and called 911. She was taken to the hospital, treated, and then sent to a rehabilitation center in a nursing home. After 100 days, as per her insurance, she was now considered a long-term patient. She's now 100 years old, blind, lying in bed 24 hours a day, except when I visit her and take her to the patio in a wheelchair. She's in an unfamiliar place and hears screaming, crying, and cursing all night from other patients. She's relatively lucid despite her circumstances, and the only thing that's keeping her alive is the hope that she can go back to her small studio apartment soon, a place where she has lived for 50 years. She said she wants to die if she can't go home. Because she was protected by APS and is now in a guardianship arrangement under the care of the nursing home, I can no longer legally pay her bills or take care of any paperwork. This has meant that her rent has not been paid and eviction proceedings are in the works. I've tried to get myself listed as a contact for her to at least be able to advocate for better services, but have come up against a wildly frustrating catch-22 situation. She has been deemed incompetent by the nursing home and therefore can't name me as a contact. I requested to have her evaluated again because I don't believe she's incompetent, and the answer was that only her contact can make that request. My question to you is, do I tell her the truth, that she's never going home? Will taking away that hope make her give up her will to live? And should her will to live be based on a false premise? The social worker at the nursing home won't even talk to me because I'm not a legal contact, and so the decision to tell her the truth lies with me. She has no one else. And Kwame writes, this story is heartbreaking, and I fear all too common, as kinless older adults grow in number. All sorts of factors play a role, some benevolent. These include an attitude toward elder care that puts safety ahead of freedom, and the well-intended use of provisions like the guardianship process that deny people their autonomy. Nursing homes aren't always unaffected by financial incentives either. The 100 days of rehabilitation that Medicare can mostly cover, followed by the Medicare-funded long-term care that, at a lower rate, still keeps a bed filled. Petitioning to have patients deemed incapacitated with guardianship assigned to a third party can make bill collection easier too. What's unusual here, I suspect, is mainly that you're around to bear witness to it. There might be an institutional temptation to keep her in the dark so that she will be easier to manage. But it's her life. She has a right to know as much of what is happening to her as she can understand, and a right to respond accordingly. First, though, be sure that she has exhausted her options. You can try to convey your concerns to a long-term care ombudsman, who by federal law serves as an advocate for residents. Your state probably also has an elder abuse center and elder advocacy groups that you could consult. This woman simply wants to live out her days in her own home. That shouldn't be too much to ask. Yet her options and yours are sadly limited. There's a need for systemic reform here. We are too easily willing and able to justify radical measures such as guardianship and do not yet have more humane, dignified solutions in place. Laura Mosqueda, an elder care and elder abuse expert at the Keck School of Medicine of the University of Southern California, tells me about cases like the one you describe. As our bodies and minds grow frail, conflicts arise between protecting us and respecting us. Institutional arrangements meant to save us from misery can end up inflicting it. I'll read another letter to the ethicist. A thief returned my stolen bike. Do I owe him a reward? The magazine's ethicist columnist on whether every promise has to be kept. My 25-year-old son was using my mountain bike for his grass-cutting business when it was stolen. He felt bad. I felt mad. I ran an ad. Mountain bike stolen. $500 reward. No questions asked. To my surprise, I got a response from someone, and we set a time to meet. Then I became worried that I was being set up to be robbed, so I called my son. Next thing I knew, there were six hulking 20-somethings tagging along with me in my minivan. At the agreed-upon meeting spot, the guy appeared with my bike in hand. I got out, then the six big guys got out, and while I'm looking the bike over, they said in no uncertain terms that it was not necessary for me to pay for the bike. The guy looked scared, and I wanted things to end safely, so I peeled off half the stack. How about $250? The guy took the money and ran off. Should I instead have given him the original amount, or do I owe him nothing? And Kwame writes, the practice of offering no questions asked rewards can be a useful one. The victims get their goods back for less than it would cost to buy replacements. The thieves get some money, pay no penalty, whereas simply putting the goods on the market may put them at risk of exposure and punishment. Win-win. That's the argument for honoring the practice. On the other hand, the practice may itself promote petty theft. An opportunistic thief can think, hey, maybe they offer me a no-questions-asked reward. This is why many governments are reluctant to pay off hostage takers, leery of encouraging more of the same. The stakes are far smaller in cases like yours, but the same logic argues against honoring the practice. It's also relevant that, by your account, your six-man football team wasn't threatening violence. It was convened to prevent it. Notice that these arguments aren't about the rights and wrongs of a particular case. They're about the merits of having a rule that says you'll honor this practice or that you won't. So-called rule utilitarians think you should commit to the rule that would have the best overall results if everyone followed it. But how are we to know which rule that would be? My own way of thinking about the matter is simpler. You shouldn't have to pay people to do what they ought to do anyway. Because this person should never have put you in the situation that led to your offer. He would have had no grounds to object if you chose not to keep the agreement. You would have been free, in my view, to give this fellow nothing. All right, another ethicist letter. Is it ever morally acceptable to visit a Confederate historical site? The magazine's ethicist columnist on tourism in Beauvoir, the former home of Jefferson Davis. And the letter begins, I recently moved back to Biloxi, Mississippi, and I'm wondering about visiting the lavish grounds of Beauvoir, the historical site and home of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederate States of America. I abhor everything the Confederacy stood for and was proud when Mississippi changed our state flag a few years ago to remove the Confederate emblem. I also enjoy history and historical sites, however, and Beauvoir is the biggest one in the area by far. My problem is that the site charges an admission fee. The property is owned by the Mississippi Division of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. And while I presume some of the money would go to the upkeep of this historical site, I don't know what they do with the rest of their money. Their website mentions events to commemorate Confederate Memorial Day, Jefferson Davis's birthday, and so on. Is it ethical to pay an admission fee and visit this historical site? Signed by Jacob. And the ethicist writes, "What can you say about the Sons of Confederate Veterans? Not long ago, the group exhumed the remains of Nathan Bedford Forrest, the Confederate general and grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, and had them ceremonially reburied in Columbia, Tennessee, where the SCV owns and operates the National Confederate Museum, devoted to presenting, quote, a Southern perspective on the war between the states. If you're wondering about this perspective, the Mississippi Division of the SCV explains that, quote, the preservation of liberty and freedom was the motivating factor in the South's decision to fight the Second American Revolution. That's part of the standard myth of the Lost Cause, a myth that has draped itself like Spanish moss over a number of Southern sites commemorating the Confederacy. So is the notion of the kindly slave owner. It's not particularly relevant to Beauvoir, where Davis moved only after emancipation. But at Briarfield and at the White House of the Confederacy, Davis appears to have believed that he was a benevolent master to the black people he considered property. The magazine Smithsonian, in a 2018 report, quotes a Beauvoir guide assuring visitors that Jefferson Davis was one of the good slave owners who took care of his slaves and treated them like family. Like family? It's a curious family whose members regularly flee when they can. Among those Davis kept enslaved, William A. Jackson, a coachman, escaped Davis's Confederate White House in 1862. Two more workers, Betsy and Jim, left together early in 1864, followed over the next several weeks by members of the household staff, Henry, Davis's butler, and Cornelius, another domestic servant. Many of the enslaved at Briarfield were forced to help build the defenses at Vicksburg, where at least four of them died. The odiousness of slavery is not rectified by avoiding physical abuse. Given that enslaving others is intrinsically bad, it's odd that this should need repeating. There's no such thing as a good master. All of which is to say, I share your doubts about whether the SCV merits your support. For what it's worth, though, my bet is that Beauvoir isn't generating money for the Sons of Confederate Veterans or any of its divisions. Its tax returns over the past several years show sizable annual operating losses. Admissions represents less than half of its revenue. $100,000 a year comes from the Mississippi State Legislature. This is no cash cow. And we can surely benefit by visiting and studying the homes of people who were living in serious moral error, even if the managers and the guides sometimes appear oblivious to it. Majestic places like Beauvoir were sustained by the unpaid labor of unfree workers. The name Beauvoir means beautiful to view. If you visit, you might remind the guides that a full appreciation of the site requires taking in the ugliness too. I'll end with Judge John Hodgman on getting a colonoscopy. What should you do with a husband who doesn't like doctors? Carolyn writes, "My husband, 57, refuses to get a colonoscopy, the shingles vaccine, or an updated tetanus shot. He doesn't like doctors and believes our medical system encourages unnecessary procedures. I told him that if he gets any of these afflictions, I won't take care of him. He says I'm a terrible person. Am I?" And the judge writes, "You're not a terrible person for not treating him unless you're a hobbyist oncologist or hoarder of prescription antivirals who maybe also has an IC unit in the garage. I never use this word, but dude, yes, it's hard to admit our body is a failing meat machine. But everyone who doesn't like doctors sure does start loving them once they get cancer or writhe in pain from preventable diseases. While making yourself vulnerable is always uncomfortable, my colonoscopy was the greatest nap I ever took. I can't wait for my next one. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.